This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and welcome to another edition of Did You Know?
This is Para Tolleson. This program has been designed for a print and visually impaired audience. Bob's a little late this week, so we're going to have to start without him. I'm sure there's a good reason why he's late, and he'll let you know as soon as he comes up with it.
Meanwhile, we are coming to the end of April and the beginning of May. The month of May gets its name from the goddess of spring and fertility, Maia.
According to Greek mythology, Maia was eldest of the daughters of Atlas, who were called the Pleiades. Not only was she the oldest, but she was the most beautiful.
Under Roman mythology, she became identified as the goddess of spring, and so the month of May was named after her. And given her status as goddess, she was accessible only to women. Men were excluded from her presence.
Which may be the reason why Bob is late.
Para, this is just mythology.
Because it's mythology, does that mean it's wrong?
Point taken. Anyway, that introduces us to the coming of the month of May.
Did you know that the month of May has been designated as Older Americans Month?
Yes, I did. It honors the nation's senior citizens, the fastest growing segment of our population. Regardless of age, the human mind is an intricate, organic computer. Each of us is the sole owner and operator of a semi-intuitive, parallel processor of cognitive data.
This is Bob Martin. Did I miss anything?
There may be some exceptions.
Oh, sorry I'm late, but I was thinking about something, so I pulled over and stopped for a minute.
You stopped driving to think?
Well, you shouldn't drive while on the cell phone.
So?
So I stopped.
Were you talking on the cell phone?
No, I don't even own a cell phone.
And what were you thinking about?
The thrilling days of yesteryear.
What about the past?
Oh, not what happened to me years ago. Old-time radio. A fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust and hearty, hi, old Silver! The Lone Ranger rides again. With his faithful Indian companion Tonto, the daring and resourceful masked rider of the plains led the fight for law and order in the early West. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. The Lone Ranger rides again.
I see. Remembering those days of radio where you listened to all the stories.
And not just listen. Those were the days you could actually keep working around the house and still listen.
And as a kid, even get scared to death. Special effects are all right, but they can't beat imagination. Remember Bill Cosby doing the bit about the giant chicken heart? Bump, 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 bump.
Oh, yeah. You're curled up in front of the radio.
Arms wrapped around your knees.
Sitting in the dark.
Right, the lights had to be off.
Ooh, come on, scare me, scare me.
They usually did.
Can we remember any of the other show openings?
How about, I am the Whistler, and I know many things because I walk at night. I know many strange tales hidden in the hearts of men and women who have stepped into the shadows. I know of the nameless terrors of which they dare not speak.
What evil lurks in the heart of man. The shadow knows.
Good evening. Welcome to the inner sanctum. Come on in through the squeaking door. Have your picture taken with the corpse?
This was a fun show because of the openings. Raymond Edward Johnson and then Paul McGrath hosted the show and pulled some awful puns with an oily chuckle. But there was also a cheery spokeswoman, Mary Bennett, who took the lead in to a commercial. For instance, maybe you'll be lucky and there will be lots of blood.
Oh, don't talk that way. I'm sure our listeners would rather hear about Lipton tea and its brisk flavor.
And tales well calculated to keep you in suspense and lights.
How about the daytime shows? And now, the romance of Helen Trent. The real-life drama of Helen Trent, who, when life mocks her, breaks her hopes, dashes her against the rocks of despair, fights back bravely, successfully, to prove what so many women long to prove in their own lives, that because a woman is 35 or more, romance in life need not be over, that romance in life can extend into middle life, and even beyond.
Now we present again Backstage Wife, the story of Mary Noble, a little Iowa girl who married one of America's handsomest actors, Larry Noble, matinee idol of a million other women, the story of what it means to be the wife of a famous actor.
The story of a modern marriage, the second Mrs. Burton.
Now to the many friends who wait for him, we present Just Plain Bill, Barber of Hartville, the story of a man who might be living next door to you, the real-life story of people just like people we all know.
One Man's Family, a Carlton E. Morris creation, is dedicated to the mothers and fathers of the younger generation and to their bewildering offspring.
We give you now Stella Dallas, a continuation on the air of the true life story of mother love and sacrifice, in which Stella Dallas saw her daughter Laurel marry into wealth and society, and realizing the difference in their status, went out of Laurel's life.
We all know couples like lovable, impractical Lorenzo Jones and his devoted wife Belle, who loves him. Their struggle for security is anybody's story, but somehow, with Lorenzo, it has more smiles.
Portia Faces Life, a story reflecting the courage, spirit, and integrity of American women everywhere.
And remember the three rings and then...
By grannies, Abner, I believe that's our ring. By doggies, Slum, I believe you're right. I'll see. Hello? Jot 'em down, store. This is Slum and Abner.
Now that we've got our memories back in old-time radio, how about a little quiz?
I'm up for that.
Oh, me too.
All right. Who lived at 77 Wistful Vista?
77 Wistful Vista?
Oh, I know. The guy with the closet.
Right. Deborah McGee and Molly.
We had a bit about the shadow. What was his name?
Lamont Cranston.
And who was the only person that could see him?
Lois Lane.
No, that's Superman. It was Margot Lane.
And how was he able to make himself invisible?
Well, he had learned a secret in the Orient, where he could cloud men's minds so they couldn't see him. That way, he could appear invisible.
Can appearances be deceiving when you're invisible?
What?
Never mind. How about only the names have been changed to protect the innocent?
Dragnet.
Before becoming the biggest female TV star in the 1960s, Lucille Ball had a radio show.
I Love Lucy.
Too soon. A radio show that evolved into I Love Lucy.
My favorite husband.
Right. Now, with a supporting cast of Mel Blanc, Phil Harris, Dennis Day, and Mary Livingston, this comedian played the worst violin on radio for 30 years.
Jack Benny.
And what was the butler's name?
Rochester.
Oh, yes. The name of the comedian that he had a running feud with for years?
Fred Allen. You know, he must have really disliked him.
No, he didn't. They were the best of friends and carried on their comic feud for years. They were so convincing that many people actually did think they disliked each other.
Speaking of Fred Allen, did you know that one time his musical director was a 19-year-old named Richard Rodgers, and author Herman Wouk got his start writing for the Fred Allen Show?
And before we leave Jack Benny, you remember what Phil Harris used to call him?
Yes, Jackson.
And what kind of car did Jack Benny drive?
An old one?
Yes, it was a Maxwell.
Okay. Leaving Jack Benny, there's only one way to deal with killers and spoilers, and that's with a U.S. Marshal and the smell of...
Gun smoke, Marshal Matt Dillon.
And who played Matt Dillon on radio?
William Conrad. I loved his voice. When Gunsmoke moved to television, it was a long time before I could watch it, because James Armes didn't sound like Matt Dillon.
And then you saw William Conrad in Jake and the Fat Man and Cannon.
Yep, and I understood. Conrad didn't look like Matt Dillon.
Did you know that at first they wanted John Wayne to play that role? Wayne suggested James Arness.
Did you know that James Arness was brother to Peter Graves, who starred in Mission Impossible?
One last radio question. On October 30th, 1938, a program was broadcast that became what might be the single most remembered radio show ever.
The Mercury Theater on the Air production of War of the Worlds.
Under the direction of Orson Welles.
Most of us have heard about what a terrible panic that broadcast caused. but some of the details might be interesting. The Mercury Radio Theater was one of the most highly regarded dramatic shows on the airwaves. It was founded jointly by John Houseman and Orson Welles. The troupe included actors Agnes Moorehead, Joseph Cotten, Hans Conried, Will Geer, and Everett Sloan.
People had been told that the production was fiction, it was an adaptation of H.G. Wells' story by the same name, and remember, it was held the night before Halloween.
But what did happen during the broadcast?
The program started with an introduction of the novel, describing the intentions of the aliens. It also specified that the following adaptation was set in 1929, 1 year after the broadcast.
The program continued as a weather report and an ordinary dance band show. They began to have more and more frequent news breaks with reports of an invasion taking place outside of Grover Mills, New Jersey. The invasion reached its climax as reporters supposedly described five great machines crossing the Hudson River. Finally, after the reporter drops out, you hear a lone radio operator calling, "Isn't there anyone on the air? Isn't there anyone?"
Then came an intermission for a station identification, during which announcer Dan Seymour mentioned the show's fictionality. Then followed Orson Welles as the scientist he had played earlier, in which he describes the aftermath of the attack, ending exactly as Welles' novel had. The alien invaders were destroyed by human germs. In essence, they die of a common cold.
After the play, Orson Welles breaks character to remind the listeners that the broadcast was a Halloween concoction, as he put it, dressing up in a sheet and saying boo.
Afterwards, many claimed that the disclaimer was added only when CBS thought they had a problem, but the working script for the play shows the disclaimer as part of the original plan.
But there was some panic, wasn't there?
Yes, but how much and what actually caused it has been debated. Here are some points for consideration. It is estimated that 6 million people listened to the Mercury broadcast. Of those, only 1.7 million believed it to be an actual occurrence.
In comparison, NBC was broadcasting the Edgar Bergen and the Charlie McCarthy show opposite them. They had 30 million listeners with no announcements of an invasion. And in Cleveland, Jack Parr was on the air and told people that the world was not coming to the end. He said, "Trust me, have I ever lied to you?" Some accused Parr of a cover-up.
But there's got to be more.
Well, there is. While the Mercury audience was small in comparison with NBC, the aftermath was huge. Within a month, there were 12,500 newspaper articles about the broadcast. But later studies suggested that the panic was way less than what the newspapers suggested.
In a book by Stanley Baron and Dennis David, entitled Mass Communication Theory, it is suggested that at the time, many newspapers felt that this new technology, radio, would spell the end of newspapers. So many journalists took every opportunity to describe the dangers of radio. Also, there were the days of yellow journalism, and so reporters often embellished or just plain made up stories. This might have been happening here.
Did you know even Hitler got in the act by pointing out that the popular reaction to a radio show was an example of the decadence of American democracy?
Did you know that on the weekend nearest to the 50th anniversary of the broadcast, West Windsor Township, New Jersey, where Grover's Mill is located, held a Martian festival, complete with carnival rides, booths, and a laser light show?
The New Yorker magazine said, "It's not often we get to see Martian women invade. The purpose of the festival? To raise tourist revenue."
Okay, I think it's bell time. Did you know that Panama hats are actually made in Ecuador?
Did you know that the original Volkswagen Beetle was commissioned by Adolf Hitler and designed by Ferdinand Porsche?
That the Venus flytrap feeds primarily on ants, not flies.
That tigers have striped skin, not just striped fur.
That according to the film's animators, every time you watch 101 Dalmatians, you'll see 6,469,952 black spots.
That the title role in Beetlejuice was written for Sammy Davis Jr.
Did you know Burt Reynolds was cast as Han Solo in Star Wars, but dropped out before filming began?
That Cinderella has been made into a movie more often than any other story.
That the phrase hanky-panky was originally a magician's term. He used a handkerchief in one hand to divert attention away from what his other hand was doing.
That a book of maps is called an atlas because early editions commonly featured a picture of Atlas carrying the world on his shoulders.
That Big Ben is not the clock, but the 13-ton bell inside the clock tower.
Did you know the easternmost state of the United States is Alaska?
Did you know that the westernmost state of the United States is Alaska? The international date line runs through the Alaska Territory.
Did you know that there are portions of Wisconsin that are farther east than Florida?
That there are parts of Michigan that if you travel south, the first foreign country you'll reach would be Canada.
That Reno, Nevada is farther west than Los Angeles, California.
That Maine is the only state whose name is just one syllable.
Speaking of states, do you know in which state Davy Crockett was born?
Unless this is a trick question, it was Tennessee.
And that's what the Fronk says. Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee.
What if I were to say that he was born in North Carolina?
Well, I'd say you were wrong.
Well, I'll tell you a story, and then you decide. Following the Revolutionary War, the Congress of the Confederation was heavily in debt. To try and help the situation, the state of North Carolina, in April of 1784, ceded 29 million acres to the Congress. This area lay in the western section of North Carolina between the Appalachian Mountains and the Mississippi River.
This area included the Watauga Association settlers who had settled around present-day Nashville and had formed the Western District of North Carolina. Their biggest fear was that the cash-starved Congress might sell the territory to either France or Spain.
Now, don't forget the fears of the settlers. But a few months later, a newly elected North Carolina legislature rescinded the grant of secession. They feared that the grants would not be used for the purpose of reducing the debt, so they relaid claim on the area. It belonged to North Carolina again.
Not good enough for the residents of the area. They didn't trust the North Carolina legislature either. With the spirit of the American Revolution still in the air, the representatives of four eastern counties of North Carolina met on August 23, 1784, and seceded from North Carolina.
Their feeling was they wanted their own way, and on May 16, 1785, the area sent a delegation to the federal government asking to be admitted into the Union as a separate state, the state of Franklin. Their initial appeal failed the two-third majority required.
When the legislature met again the next month and a new speaker was elected, the area attempted statehood again. To better their chances of success, they changed the name of the new state from Frankland to Franklin, in honor of patriot Benjamin Franklin. They even tried to appeal to Franklin directly for support. Franklin politely declined. The request failed by two votes.
Although statehood was refused, the area conducted business as the independent state of Franklin. In 1786, North Carolina offered a waiver of back taxes if Franklin would rejoin North Carolina. That offer was refused. They now found themselves in the difficult position of having no military support from either the federal government or the state of North Carolina.
This resulted in a major problem in March of 1788 when Indian tribes began to attack settlers in the area with abandon. Franklin appealed for financial support from Spain. North Carolina objected to any foreign power becoming involved, so they sent troops in and reclaimed the area. By 1790, North Carolina was firmly in control of the area and again ceded the area to the national government as part of a Southwest Territory, which became the state of Tennessee in 1796.
So, North Carolina until 1784, Frankland briefly, then Franklin from 1785 to 1788, then North Carolina again, then Southwest Territory, and finally Tennessee in 1796. Davy Crockett was born August 17th, 1786.
Born on a mountaintop in North Carolina, Franklin, Southwest Territory, Tennessee. Oh, whatever. America.
In 1786, David Crockett was born in the state of Franklin, but definitely in America.
Maybe we lost out on Davy by a couple of years, but here are some other events from North Carolina. Did you know that the first duel in North Carolina occurred at Brunswick on March 18, 1765. It involved two British naval officers who were fighting over a local woman's affections.
I hope the lady was happy with the outcome, because you remember what Shakespeare once said, "Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned."
Did you know that is a popular misbelief? Not only did Shakespeare not say it, but the quote is also incorrect. The phrase is found in a play, The Mourning Bride, written in 1697 by William Congreve. The entire phrase is, "Heaven hath no rage like love to hatred turned, nor hell a fury like a woman scorned."
We don't know whether or not if it was over a woman, but the first duel between Native North Carolinians was fought in Wilmington behind the Episcopal Church on July 11, 1787. John Bradley killed Samuel Swan and was charged with murder. He was later pardoned by the governor.
One of the most famous duels in North Carolina history occurred September 5, 1802, when John Stanley killed former Governor Richard Speight behind the Masonic Hall in New Bern.
Politics seemed to be a big factor in dueling. Between 1800 and 1860, political rivalry accounted for 27 incidents of dueling.
The last recorded duel took place on May 3, 1865, when Joseph Flanner killed a fellow resident of Wilmington, William Wilkins.
Did you know they went across the state line into South Carolina for the event?
Did you know that on June 30th, 1940, a 6-foot iceberg appeared off of Salter Path on Bogue Banks? That's 6 feet above the water, and it was as large as a small island.
Didn't you know there are 98 military installations in North Carolina during the Civil War?
A while back, we told the story of the battle between the ironclads, Monitor and Virginia, formerly the Merrimack. That battle had occurred in March of 1862. After being reconditioned late in December, the Monitor was heading toward South Carolina when it ran into heavy squalls off the North Carolina coast. High waves flooded the boilers and killed the engines. On December 31, 1862, she sank with 16 men still aboard just off Cape Hatteras.
You've probably heard of the phrase hue and cry, relating to some kind of an argument. But did you know it is a legal term and was once part of North Carolina law? The practice was common under English common law as far back as 1275 and was regularly applied in colonial Carolina. What was involved was that if anyone witnessed a robbery or felony, he was required to raise a hue and cry by voice and horn for the pursuit and capture of the culprit.
Such pursuits were not always successful, but in the absence of any better or faster means of pursuit, the hue and cry statute was reenacted by the legislature in 1749. Four provisions for the procedure were set forth in a work entitled The Office and Authority of a Justice of the Peace, published in New Bern in 1774.
It's a damn long time between drinks.
What?
Don't worry. Believe it or not, it's a famous North Carolina saying.
Oh, I remember. It was said by Governor Zebulon Vance in answer to the question, "What did the governor of North Carolina say to the governor of South Carolina?"
He may have said it, but there is evidence that it had been said before. In the 1840s, there was some serious discussions taking place between North Carolina Governor John Motley Moorhead and South Carolina Governor James H. Hammond. At one point, the discussion got rather heated. That's when Governor Moorhead said, "It's a damn long time between drinks." The comment had the effect of relaxing tensions and restoring goodwill, and settlement was achieved.
It was also reported to have been said between Governors Edward Dudley and Pierce Mason Butler in 1838.
That was a lot better than having a duel.
Yes, it was. The phrase has been used since the 1890s to refer to any kind of a long and tedious process. It got a rebirth following the repeal of Prohibition in 1933. Although alcohol was no longer illegal, selling liquor by the drink remained illegal in both North and South Carolina.
Therefore, passengers on the train between Washington, D.C. and Atlanta found themselves with a long time between drinks because the club car on the train was closed while passing through the Carolinas.
When former Senator Sam Irvin was giving a speech to the North Carolina Literary and Historical Association, he used this phrase as an example of the life and humor of the Southern culture. He said, North Carolinians have always loved to laugh. Their own merry hearts and the many humorists abiding among them have always allowed them to indulge this love.
One of the best examples of this early humor comes from Ham Jones. He was a UNC graduate and a lawyer. In the early 1800s, his Cousin Sally Dillard sketches poked fun at Southern life and culture, especially its court system.
Have we got an example?
Yes, we do. This is our adaptation of the story as it appeared in the Saturday Evening Post. The scene is a court of justice in North Carolina. A beardless disciple of Themis rises and thus addresses the court. May it please your worships, and you, gentlemen of the jury, since it has been my fortune, good or bad, I will not say, to exercise myself in legal disquisitions. It has never before befallen me to be obligated to denounce a breach of the peace so enormous and transcending as the one now claiming attention. A more barbarous, direful, marked, and malicious assault, a more willful, violent, dangerous, and murderous battery, and finally a more diabolical breach of the peace has seldom happened in a civilized country, and I dare say that it has seldom been your duty to pass upon one so shocking to benevolent feelings as this, as took place at Captain Rice's in this county, but you will hear it from the witnesses.
Now, the witnesses being sworn, two or three were examined and deposed. One, that he had heard the noise but didn't see the fight. Another, that he had saw the row but didn't see who struck first. The third, that he was very drunk and couldn't say much about the scrimmage at all. Now follows the examination of the fourth witness, Mrs. Harris. I'll be the judge, Farrow will be the witness, and Kurt is the prosecutor, Lawyer Chops.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, to have occupied so much of your time with the stupidity of the witness examined. It arose, gentlemen, altogether from misapprehension on my part. Had I known, as I know now, that I had a witness in attendance who was well acquainted with all the circumstances of the case and was able to make herself clearly and intelligibly understood by the court and jury, I should not have so long trespassed on your time and patience. Come forward, Mrs. Harris. Mrs. Harris, we want you to tell us all about the riot that happened the other day at Rice's. And as a good deal of time has already been wasted in circumlocution, we wish you to be as compendious and at the same time as explicit as possible.
Exactly. Captain Rice, he getting a treat, and Cousin Sal Dillard, she came over to our house and asked my husband if his wife, that be me, Martin Goat. He told Sally Dillard that I was poorly, being as how I had touched our rheumatics in my hip, and the big swamp was up, and there had been a heap of rain lately. But however, since it was she, Cousin Sally Dillard, I mightn't go. But he told Cousin Sally Dillard that Mouse, he was the foreman on the crop, and the grass was smartly in the grass, but however, as is she, Cousin Sally Dillard, most, he mightn't go.
In the name of common sense, what did you mean by all this rigmarole?
Cam Rice, he gave him a treat, and Cousin Sal Dillard, she came over to our house and asked my husband if his wife, that being me, Mount Go, and he told Cousin Sal Dillard...
Stop, please. We don't want to hear anything about Cousin Sally Dillard or you. Tell us about the fight at Rice's.
Well, sir, if you let me.
Well, go ahead.
Well, Captain Rice, he getting a treat, and Cousin Sal Dillard, she came over to our house and asked my husband if his wife, that being me, Mount Gaul.
We want to know about the fight, and you must not proceed in this impertinent story. Do you know anything about the matter before the court?
To be sure I do.
Will you go on and tell it and nothing else?
Well, Captain Rice, he getting a treat.
This is intolerable! May it please the court, I move that this witness be committed for contempt. She seems to me to be trifling with the court.
Witness, you are now before a court of justice. Unless you behave yourself in a more becoming manner, you will be sent to jail. So, begin and tell what you know about the fight at Captain Rice's.
Well, gentlemen, Captain Rice, he getting a treat, and Cousin Sal Dillard...
I hope this witness may be ordered into custody.
Mr. Attorney... The court is of the opinion that we may save time by letting the witness go on in her own way. Proceed, Mrs. Harris, with your story, but please stick to the point.
Yes, gentlemen. Well, Captain Rice, he get in the tree, and Cousin Saldilla, she came over to my house and asked my husband if his wife, that be me, mountain goat. My husband told Cousin Saldilla that I was poorly being as I had been rheumatizing my hip, and the big swamp was in the road, and the big swamp was up. But howsomever, as it was she, Cousin Dilla, she told her that I might go. Well, Cousin Dilla then asked my mouse if he might go. My husband told Cousin Saldilla as he mouse was in the foreman of the crop, and that crop was small in the grass. But howsomever, as it was she, Cousin Dilla, my aunt go. And so we went, mouse, me, and Cousin Saldilla. And we cousin to the big swamp, and the big swamp was up, and I was telling you, but being how it was such a long cross the big swamp, Cousin Sally and most like, gentle folks, and they walked along. But me, like a dang fool, horse up my petticoats and wadded. And gentlemen, as the height of what I do know about it.
And that is part of the humor tradition of 1830 North Carolina, courtesy of the University of Virginia Library.
You know what we ought to do now?
What?
Earlier we had an old-time radio quiz. Do you have a North Carolina quiz?
Does a bear live in the woods? Okay, here we go. What is the nickname for the city of Raleigh?
The city of Oaks.
Where is the geographical center of the state?
Chatham, 10 miles northwest of Sanford.
What is the longest river in North Carolina?
The Cape Fear River. It's 202 miles long, only 7 miles longer than the Neuse River. There are other longer rivers that flow through North Carolina, but they are not entirely within the state's boundaries.
Do you happen to know what the river was named before it was called the Cape Fear?
Yes, I do. In 1526, it was called Rio Jordan by Spanish explorers. Afterwards, it was called the Charles River and the Clarendon River before it became Cape Fear somewhere around 1733.
Notice that Para and I were not around when that happened. What is the state vegetable?
The sweet potato. North Carolina is the largest producer of sweet potatoes in the nation.
What is the state mammal?
The gray squirrel.
What is the largest city in North Carolina?
Charlotte, followed by Raleigh and Greensboro.
What city is known as the furniture capital of the world?
High Point.
Do you know the origin of these cities' names? Raleigh.
Named after Sir Walter Raleigh.
Charlotte.
Named for the German princess Charlotte of Mecklenburg.
Apex.
Meaning peak, it's the highest point on the Chatham Railroad line between Richmond, Virginia, and Jacksonville, Florida.
And Cary.
It was originally a settlement in 1750 called Bradford's Ordinary. In 1854, Allison Francis Page bought 300 acres for the start of a new city and named it after a former Ohio congressman and prohibitionist, Samuel Fenton Cary.
Before we leave city names, did you know that New Bern was originally named by German and Swiss settlers after Bern, Switzerland? And that town was supposedly named by a group of hunters who said they would name the settlement after the first animal they came across on their expedition.
The first animal they saw was a bear. Bern is the old Germanic word for bear.
Did You Know has tried to bring some different slants on history and events during the years. We have one now that is different still. This one isn't going to be fact that corrects a misconception. It's more like some different facts about an event that might change our opinion. Sound strange? Well, let's see.
This story isn't about some earth-changing event, but a strange slant about what we believe and why. There's an old belief that Babe Ruth candy bar was named for the baseball great Babe Ruth.
Then came along evidence that said that that wasn't true. It was named for Grover Cleveland's daughter, Ruth. What if it really was named for Babe Ruth?
Well, here's the story. In 1916, a German immigrant, Otto Schnering, founded the Curtis Candy Company in Chicago. Because of the anti-German sentiment raging from World War I, he decided not to use his own German surname, but instead chose his mother's maiden name for the business, Curtis.
His first product was the Crunchy Snack and had a pastry center covered with peanuts and chocolate. He called it Candy Cake. The snack was only marginally successful, so to boost sales, he renamed the treat Baby Ruth in 1921.
5 years later, the company was selling millions of dollars worth of the candy bar. Reporters kept asking Curtis for the source of the name. The manufacturer kept saying that he named the bar in honor of former President Grover Cleveland's daughter, Ruth. Was he?
Grover Cleveland had left office in 1897. Ruth Cleveland died of diphtheria in January of 1904. Otto Schnering opened the Curtis Candy Company in 1916.
Babe Ruth was traded to New York Yankees and hit 54 home runs in 1920. He hit 59 in 1921. The candy bar was renamed Baby Ruth in 1920 or 1921. The 1921 date is the one most often cited.
So it was named after Babe Ruth.
Let's say maybe. One source says that the trademark was patterned after the engraved lettering that was used on the medallion that was struck for the Chicago World's Columbian Exposition in 1893.
So, it was for Cleveland's daughter.
Again, maybe. The exposition was 19 years before Schnering started the company. Also, the following year, the same source offered another possibility. He now suggests the bar was named after the granddaughter of George Williamson.
Who is George Williamson?
The originator of the candy bar, who sold the formula to Schnering.
And a candy bar named for Ruth Williamson? Who'd buy it?
Exactly the point.
Plus, another source points out that Mr. Williamson was the head of a rival company and the originator of the O. Henry bar.
So, why would he have sold a formula to a rival company?
Let's go back for a possible answer. In 1932, after the World Series game when Ruth supposedly called his home run, the Chicago-based Curtis Company installed an illuminated sign on the rooftop of one of the flats across Sheffield Avenue in Chicago, close to where Ruth had hit his home run.
Back in 1923, Schnering had chartered a plane to drop thousands of Baby Ruth bars over the city of Pittsburgh.
In 1995, a company representing the Ruth estate licensed his name and likeness for use in a Baby Ruth marketing campaign.
In the spring of 2007, an edition of the Chicago Cubs game program showed a partially unwrapped Baby Ruth in front of the Wrigley Field Ivy with the caption, "The official candy bar of Major League Baseball and proud sponsor of the Chicago Cubs."
Okay, but that's just advertising after the fact. You have to pay someone for the use of their name.
Who'd they pay in 1921?
Oh.
That reminds me of a bumper sticker I saw the other day. Out of my mind. Back in 5 minutes.
Speaking of bumper stickers, here are some others that we've seen. Forget about world peace. Visualize using your turn signals.
Don't like my driving? Then quit watching me.
As long as there are tests, there will be prayer in school.
There's no such thing as a dumb blonde. This sticker was seen applied upside down.
Meandering to a different drummer.
Vegetarian, an old Indian word for lousy hunter.
Everyone has a photographic memory. Some just don't have film.
I drive way too fast to worry about cholesterol.
So many cats, so few recipes.
A bartender is just a pharmacist with a limited inventory.
Warning, I have an attitude and know how to use it.
You are depriving some poor village of its idiot.
Where did you see that one?
Somebody stuck it on the back of my car.
Para, you didn't. Oh, my God. Okay, all right, we have a few other stories about things that didn't really happen the way we were told. Back in the late 1960s, there were a lot of reports about bra burnings in support of women's rights. Well, this is what really happened. In 1968, Robin Morgan and some other activists organized a protest of that year's Miss America pageant. They thought of burning bras and other symbols of female beauty culture, but later decided against it because they considered it a fire hazard.
The mainstream media got wind of the initial plans and then reported it as if it had actually happened, which it had not. Instead, they threw bras, girdles, handbags, and cosmetics into garbage cans. Apparently, titillated by the word bra, the male-dominated press reported any feminist meeting as a bra burning, suggested that the burning of a brassiere was the central issue of feminism.
Later on, as a reaction to the media stories, there were some rallies where women did burn their bras, but it didn't happen in the beginning. Here was a public perception created by the press, not an actual occurrence that they had reported.
Remember the old scary movie, The Amityville Horror? The movie and its sequels claimed to be based on true events. Did you get taken in? Here are the true events. On November 13th, 1974, 6 members of the DeFeo family were shot and killed in their home in Amityville, New York. The sole remaining member of the family, Ronald DeFeo, Jr., confessed to killing his parents and siblings and was sentenced to 25 years to life.
A year after the murder, George and Kathy Lutz moved into the house, but stayed only 28 days. They claimed that the residence was possessed by demonic forces. A priest was called to perform an exorcism. A New York television station employed the use of a team of psychics and ghost hunters who confirmed the claims by the Lutz family. Jay Ensign wrote the best-selling novel in 1977, and the movie was released in 1977. We have a real haunted house.
Well, not so fast. Eventually, the truth began to leak out. Ensign confessed that he had used tape recordings from the Lutzes. He had verified nothing on his own. The priest said that he had blessed the house, not performed an exorcism, and said he had seen nothing unusual. Weather reports stated that there had been no snowfall on that night that the Lutzes claimed to have seen cloven hoof prints in the snow. And very questionably, at the time the family was supposedly scared to death over these horrible events, never once did they call the police.
That would be the first thing you would normally do. So what was behind it all? Well, apparently the Lutzes were in debt farther than they expected, and Mr. Lutz's business was in trouble. They needed a way out. They met with William Weber, Ronald DeFeo Jr.'s attorney, and after a few bottles of wine concocted the story. Weber's reason? He was hoping to get a new trial for his defendant and use "the devil made me do it" as a defense.
Other facts that came out were that although they claimed they were afraid to go back to the house, they weren't too scared to go back and have a yard sale. Subsequent buyers of the house had no troubles except for sightseers. William Weber later sued the Lutzes for reneging on a book deal.
Years later, Mr. Lutz said that he wasn't interested in setting the record straight. He was more interested in money from future book deals. So, even though the whole story of the Amityville Horror had been proven to be a hoax, there were still many people who would rather believe the horror story, claiming it's all a cover-up. Well, we still have the Blair Witch Project.
Yes, we do. That legend goes back to 1785, when Ellie Kedward, who lived in Blair Township, Maryland, was tried as a witch and banished from the community. As she left, she cursed the community. Legend says that following her leaving, there were murders, mutilations, and disappearances, all blamed on the Blair Witch.
Hearing these stories, three film students, Heather Donahue, Joshua Leonard, and Micah Williams, went to the area in 1994 to film a documentary. They entered the woods on October 21st and never came out. A year later, a duffel bag containing cameras, films, and journals were found buried under the foundation of a 100-year-old cabin.
At least, that is what the film released in 1996 wanted you to believe. It was a completely fictional story put together by filmmakers Daniel Myrick and Eduardo Sanchez. They hired the three previously unknown actors and turned them loose in the woods with cameras.
That admission won't be enough proof for some. So how about this? The movie claims that the three were never found again. Heather Donahue appeared in a film as recently as 2008. Joshua Leonard won a Best Actors Award at the Gijon Film Festival in 2009. Michael Williams appeared in an episode of Law and Order Special Victims Unit in 2009. Not bad for missing people.
In addition, the people of Burkittville, the site of the story in Blair Township, got fed up with all the gawkers coming to invade the area. They posted an online explanation that none of the story was true, and they refuted everything point by point. In reaction to the purported 33,000-hour search to find the filmmakers, even the police department tried to post information most still would not believe.
There was no Blair Witch. There was no Ellie Kedward. Even she was made up. There were no lost filmmakers. Another hoax that attracts believers. At least, there's still Jason and Freddy Krueger.
Remind me not to go walking with you down Elm Street.
What's on Elm Street?
A sign that says, if you don't pay your exorcist, you'll get repossessed.
Right. We've seen other signs like that. People who jump off a bridge in Paris are insane.
Okay. A man's home is his castle, in a manner of speaking.
My turn. Shotgun wedding. It's a case of wife or death.
Bakers trade bread recipes on a need-to-know basis.
A hangover is the wrath of grapes.
When two egotists meet, it's an eye for an eye.
A bicycle can't stand on its own because it is too tired.
She was engaged to a man with a wooden leg, but broke it off.
A chicken crossing the road is poultry in motion.
One of Santa's helpers is a subordinate clause.
A boiled egg in the morning is hard to beat.
Does the name Pavlov ring a bell?
A midget fortune teller who escapes from prison is a small medium at large.
A lot of money is tainted. Taint yours and attain a mine.
Every calendar's days are numbered.
And speaking of calendars, we're at the end of our show. We want to thank you for bearing with us and with Did You Know these many weeks. Since this is going to be the last edition of this series of programs, we thought we'd let you in on a little secret that we have kept carefully hidden. We promised that we would do a family show, and we did. Did you know we are all members of the same family? I'm Kurt Benrud, and Pam Vesper is my second cousin. Para Tollison is my great-niece. Richard Dunnigan is my father-in-law by marriage to my twin sister. Bob is my half-brother that we've kept in the closet for the past 30 years.
I'm Para Tollison, and Kurt is my third cousin, twice removed, but he keeps coming back. Richard's my grandfather on my younger sister's side by two previous marriages. Pam is my brother's sister's great-aunt, who once served with Blackbeard, and Bob is my childhood secret friend who only appeared when no adults were around.
I'm Richard Dunnigan, and Kurt is my distant nephew from my father's days as a Gandhi dancer. Pam is my kissing cousin. Para is my kissing cousin.
I thought Pam was your kissing cousin.
I like kissing cousins. And Bob is my long-lost brother who was stolen by groundhogs when he was a child and stored in an abandoned burrow. He comes back out every February 2nd.
I'm Pam Vesper, and Kurt is the one that Mother always liked the least. Para is my Aunt Polly's cousin who had a sister named Aunt Mildred. Richard likes to kiss cousins, and he appeared after my cousin kissed a frog. Bob is my brother's keeper, or keeper's brother, I keep forgetting.
I'm Bob Martin, and wow, I really have a big family. I guess I descended from a long line that somebody once heard. Anyway, you know what this means? Well, it's obvious. We all have the same uncle. And so, we are going to leave you with the story that really happened to our common uncle.
So here we go. Our uncle was good friends with Frank Buck, the famous wild animal collector. Frank used to visit our uncle at his cabin that was set way high in the Colorado Rocky Mountains. One day they were sitting out on the deck, sipping chamomile and eating scones, and looking north over the wild Colorado River. It was that kind of a cabin. When all of a sudden, the phone rang. It was that kind of a phone.
It was the Bronx Zoo calling. They wanted Frank to go down into the deepest, darkest depths of the African jungle and bring back a very rare species of animal, the Hipporhinocerotus. For this, they would pay $10,000. Frank left a half a cup of tea and immediately headed for Africa.
He boarded a tramp steamer at the mouth of the Ubangi River and headed downstream. It was that kind of river. Chugga, 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 chuggity chug. 17 miles. They came to a big, beautiful bend in the river. And what do you think they saw? Tarzan striping zebras. Black stripes on white zebras. White stripes on black zebras. Up and down, never back and forth. But why?
Duty first. Down he went to the deepest, darkest depths of the African jungle. And after 6 sweltering months, he finds and captures a Hipporhinocerotus. He loads it on board and starts back up the river.
Chugga-a-chugga, chuggity-chug, they get into the big, beautiful bend in the river, and yes, there is Tarzan striping zebras. Black stripes on white zebras and white stripes on black zebras. Up and down, never back and forth.
But just as they are about to stop, the doctor comes running up and says, Mr. Buck, your wife has just been stricken by the deadly sleepy weepy fever, and we must go on to the nearest town of Wamba Wamba to get medicine. Well, they only had been married for a month, so they went on.
I thought they had been down there for 6 months.
She didn't believe in long engagements. She was that kind of girl.
Then the rainy season set in, and they couldn't go back. It was that kind of rain.
10 years later, Frank Buck was with our uncle in his little cabin high in the Rocky Mountains. They were sitting on the west deck, sipping Earl Grey with Scottish shortbread, looking east over Lake Titicaca. It was that kind of cabin. When all of a sudden, the phone rang. It was that kind of phone.
It was the Chicago Zoo calling. They wanted Frank to go down into the deepest depths of the African jungle and bring back a very, very rare species animal, the red-headed ape.
Why was the red-headed ape so rare? Was it that kind of ape?
No, it was because Clara hadn't been developed yet. For this trip, the zoo would pay him $15,000, so Frank left 3/4 of a cup of tea, but he did take a shortbread with him. It was that kind of shortbread, and he headed for Africa.
He boarded a tramp steamer at the mouth of the Ubangi River and headed downstream. Chugga-chugga-chug, chuggity-chug. It was that kind of tramp steamer. 17 miles. They come to the big, beautiful bend in the river, and Frank is looking, looking, and then there! In the back of the clearing is Tarzan, striping zebras. Black stripes on white zebras. White stripes on black zebras. Up and down, never back and forth. But why? Why?
Duty first. Down they went into the deepest, darkest depths of the African jungle, and after 8 steaming, sweltering months, they find and they capture a red-headed ape and load him on board, and they start back up the river.
Chugga-chuggity-chug, chuggity-chug. They get to the big, beautiful bend in the river, and Frank is standing by the rail, looking, looking. Then yes, yes, there is Tarzan, striping zebras, black stripes on white zebras, white stripes on black zebras, up and down, never back and forth.
But just as they were about to stop, the first mate comes running up and says, "Mr. Buck, Mr. Buck, the crew has just mutinied, and we have to go to the nearest town of Wamba Wamba to get a new crew before the piranha attack." They were that kind of piranha.
Then the rainy season set in, and they couldn't go back. It was that kind of rain.
15 years later, Frank is sitting with our uncle in that little cabin way up in the Colorado Rockies, sipping tea with Kaiser rolls. Frank was having an English breakfast tea with lemon. He was that kind of guy. They were looking out somewhere over a rainbow on a clear day, and you could see forever. It was that kind of cabin. Then all of a sudden, the phone went, boo-ba-ba-ba-boo-ba-ba-ba. Different phone.
It was the Flasher Hacker Zoo in San Francisco calling. They wanted Frank to go down into the deepest, darkest depths of African jungle and bring back the very rarest of all rare species of animal, the slippery, slimy snake in the grass.
No, that doesn't sound so rare.
Well, the slippery, slimy snake in the grass lives in the desert. It was that kind of snake. And for this, they would pay him $25,000. Frank left his cup of tea with his finger still in the handle and headed for Africa. It was that kind of finger.
He boarded a tramp steamer at the mouth of the Ubangi River and headed downstream. Chugga, chugga, chug, chuggity chug. 17 miles. They were those kind of miles. They come to the big, beautiful bend in the river, and Frank is looking, looking, looking. He's not there. Oh, wait a minute. Yes, there he is. Tarzan striping zebras. White stripes on black zebras. Black stripes on white zebras.
I thought the black stripes came first.
They weren't those kinds of zebras. Up and down, never back and forth. But why, why?
These and other questions will finally be answered on the return trip.
But duty first. So down they go into the heart of darkness, and after 12 grueling, sweltery, steamy, sweltering months...
You said sweltering.
I like sweltering. They find and capture the last living, slippery, slimy snake in the grass. He was wrapped around the last blade of grass in the desert in the deepest, darkest depths of the African jungle. It was that kind of desert. They load him on board and start back up the river.
Chugga, chugga, chug, chuggity chug. I forgot to tell you, it was also that kind of river. They get to the big, beautiful bend. Frank is glued to the railing, looking, looking, looking. Yes, yes, yes. There he is, Tarzan striping zebras. White?
I think they know this part.
I like this part. Up and down, never back and forth. This time, no matter what, we have to stop.
But just at that moment, the boat on the ship explodes. The ship splits in half, everyone goes into the water, and the crocodiles swim in and eat everyone up. Every single person. They're that kind of crocodiles.
Except Frank Buck. He pulls out a knife and carves up 3 suitcases and 6 pairs of shoes. He swims to shore, walks up behind Tarzan, and watches him.
There he is, striping zebras.
White stripes on black zebras.
Black stripes on white zebras.
up and down,
never back and forth. And Tarzan is an old man with long white hair pulled back in a ponytail, and he has a gray-white beard. His hands are a little shaky, so the stripes on the zebras are not quite straight. So if you ever happen to see a zebra with shaky stripes, you'll know it came from Tarzan's blue period.
Frank spoke. Tarzan, I first came by here 25 years ago and saw you sitting here, striping zebras. White stripes on black zebras, black stripes on white zebras, up and down, never back and forth. And I have to know why.
Tarzan stopped painting, turned and looked at Frank, and there was a tear in his eye. And then he spoke with a shaky voice.
Why, son, I thought you knew. Tarzan stripes forever.
This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thank you for sharing in these broadcasts of Did You Know? This and all of the programming of the Triangle Radio Reading Service is designed for a print and visually impaired audience.
The initial broadcasts of Did You Know are on Thursdays at 9 p.m., Saturdays at noon, and Sunday evenings at 8. Podcasts of the show are also available on the Internet following the initial broadcast.
Since we began this program last May, the Triangle Radio Reading Service has sent out almost 100 sub-channel receivers to people who are print or visually impaired. 100 households that might not have gotten the kinds of information and entertainment that we have been able to provide.
We want to thank the many of you who have made contributions to sustain the work and special programming of the Triangle Radio Reading Service.
Your financial assistance was a vital part of what it takes to sustain our work of bringing special programming to the print and visually impaired.
You know, I'm not surprised at their generosity. After all, they are that kind of people.
This and all of the programming of the Triangle Reading Service is designed for a print and visually impaired audience. We want to leave you with one more thought. Like Linda says, TRRS is not a station on its own. We are only a part of a big network, and we'll be around everywhere. Wherever you listen, we'll be there. Wherever there are people who are visually or print impaired, we'll be there. Wherever there is a need for special programming to assist those that have the need, we'll be there. Wherever there are sub-channel receivers that will be provided to carry news and entertainment, stories and poetry, grocery ads and announcements of local happenings, we'll be there. From live presentations to available podcasts, 2 in the afternoon or 2 in the morning, any day of the week. Whatever may be the interest of someone who is print or visually impaired, we'll be there.
Thank you again for sharing with us. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye.